Bremer was speaking at the World Economic Forum and leading an Iraqi delegation, and he was even telling people what kind of changes they'll make in the constitution. It was bizarre.
They're not happy at all about an indefinite foreign occupation of their country, especially not if the occupying force is going to employ rather heavy-handed tactics.
A man drove up in a car holding up an empty water jug, and he said, "No water. America bad. Saddam good. Bush bad."
President Bush stepped up the scare tactics on October 7, just 4 days before the October vote in the Senate on the war resolution.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, June 27, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Israeli and Palestinian security officials agreed in principle today on the terms of an Israeli pullback from parts of the Gaza Strip. That's according to Palestinian officials and Israel TV. The progress on Israeli withdrawal, coupled with an agreement by militant Islamic groups to temporarily cease attacks on Israelis, provides a boost to a U.S.-backed peace plan, the Roadmap to Palestinian Statehood by 2005. Israel's military prosecutor has exonerated Israeli soldiers in the death of Rachel Corrie, 23, who was killed by an Israeli bulldozer in March as she protested the destruction of a Palestinian home at the Rafah refugee camp. The death of Corrie, a student at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, sparked debate nationally and internationally on the role and methods of activists in a volatile land. The Rafah camp on the Egyptian border has been one of the flashpoints in the Mideast conflict. The army said the home being protected by Corrie was being destroyed in an effort to block arms smuggling. Members of the International Solidarity Movement said that Corrie was visible to the bulldozer driver and that her death was malicious. Well, it's been almost 2 months since the U.S. took control of Iraq. While most Iraqis say they are glad that Saddam Hussein was removed from power, they're increasingly impatient with the slow pace of post-war reconstruction. Phone lines are still down in most of the country. Electricity is intermittent, and it's still dangerous to roam the streets of Baghdad after dark. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with Kelly Hayes Raitt, a California activist who's just arrived in Iraq on a personal humanitarian and peace-building mission. We asked her to describe how people there are feeling as they begin the long process of rebuilding their country and their lives.
Well, the mood on the street here is pretty grim. There's been no electricity or water in several parts in Baghdad for the last 4 days, and people are furious. They're blaming the American troops, and they're saying that the Americans have shut off the electricity as retaliation for people not turning in their handguns. I don't know how true that is, but I think it expresses the level of frustration that people have with not only the occupation, but just not being able to get their lives back to normal after they've lived through such unbelievable devastation. There's electricity in some parts of town for only a few hours a day. In other parts of Baghdad, there's no electricity. Without electricity, there's no running water or refrigeration or air conditioning or fans, which is really critical because the days here hit 115 degrees. It's 112 degrees right now at 8 o'clock at night where I'm sitting.
And so how do you function under those type of oppressive heat conditions and, I would say, oppressive political conditions as well under the American occupation?
Well, tempers definitely are rising as the temperature rises. My first day here, I was standing out in the street changing money. The money changers now have card tables curbside and change dinars and dollars. And I was standing out changing money, and a man drove up in a car and just started screaming at me, holding up an empty water jug like an angry fist. And he said, "No water. America bad. Saddam good. Bush bad." And spat off. And he was absolutely livid, and I was standing there in shock. But that's the kind of thing we see on the street right now.
What sort of relationship exists between the American soldiers and the average Iraqis?
The Iraqis can't stand the soldiers. I was in a car today and was nearly sideswiped by a tank. I mean, our U.S. soldiers are literally driving down the streets of Baghdad, the crowded streets of Baghdad that have no street signals in them, so they're chaotic as well as crowded. And these tanks are just rolling right down the street, and they're not made for city driving, so they don't see what they're doing. And we nearly got sideswiped by one and had angry officers shooting us looks as they drove past. you know, I think the troops are doing the best they can under the circumstances, and they're following orders. But there's a lot of insensitivity here that I think exacerbates problems. In fact, right now, as I was walking over back to my hotel, I passed the Palestine Hotel. There are 7 tanks and trucks stationed outside the Palestine driveway, checking every vehicle driving in. I mean, they make security guards at LAX look like a cakewalk. And people were mad. I mean, they want to get home before the curfew.
Mm-hmm.
And they're sitting at a checkpoint outside the Palestine Hotel.
What happens if you don't get home before the curfew?
Well, gunfire starts right around now, and the curfew's not for another couple of hours. So most people will probably make it home before then, but they want to make it home well before the gunfire starts. This is as late as I've been out since I've been here. I mean, right now I'm cowering beneath a 4-foot-high concrete wall. I do hear gunfire every night, and I hear it close enough to wake me up over the sound of the generator and our rickety air conditioning in this hotel.
Where is this gunfire coming from for those who have not been...
Just out on the street. We've been hearing it every night.
Do you have any idea who's doing the shooting and what they're shooting at? And
I don't. There's really a sense of insecurity right now, and that's what Iraqis talk about. They talk about not having job security. Of course, there are no jobs. They talk about not having personal security because there isn't much of that. You know, we talk about trying to win over the hearts and souls of the Iraqis, and I think we ought to just start with simple things like health and security. The only security that people have right now is what they can provide for themselves, because they're not seeing it coming from anywhere else.
Now, Kelly Hayes-Rate, you were last in Baghdad in February, about 5 weeks before the bombing actually started. Why have you decided to return now? And now that you're there, how are things different since your last visit?
Well, Verna, I felt like I really wasn't getting the full story from CNN or Fox News, and that's why I wanted to come back and see for myself what was happening here. It is creepy. I don't know. I can't find the word for it. It is eerie and creepy to see every single ministry building bombed except for the Ministry of Oil. Yesterday, I walked through the grounds of the Ministry of Olympics, the Olympics Ministry. The building is nothing but a 9-story shell. You could still smell the burning. It was eerily silent, and in the not too far distance, I could see the Ministry of Oil absolutely intact, and it's the only ministry building that is intact in the whole city. Today, I had a very emotionally wrenching experience of meeting someone in a neighborhood whose home had been shot at, the whole neighborhood had been shot at by a helicopter that had gone by one morning at 5 a.m. And this man took the time to talk to me about how terrifying that was, and how he and his wife and his 9-year-old son and 6-year-old daughter cowered in their living room watching people outside their front window dying and being killed by gunfire from this U.S. helicopter that was flying over the neighborhood. At one point, a shell did come through his living room and left a 12-inch gaping hole in the top part of his wall. He said, these hours were hours of death.
We're hearing reports about many children being orphaned. What can you tell us about the status of the children in Baghdad?
I haven't had a chance to visit any orphanages yet. I'm hearing a lot of rumors about them. I'm hearing that the state-run orphanages, like the one that I visited in February, have no funding anymore because there's no state to fund them. So I've heard that the kids have been let out on the street and that there's a large number of street children. I certainly do see a lot of kids running around in the street, but to be honest, schools are only operating 2 hours in the morning because it's exams, so it's hard to know if those are homeless kids or just, you know, kids on a vacation. I do know that one orphanage that was run at the Iraqi Village Center was taken over by the U.S. troops, and the kids have all been placed in families. They were able to place those kids. I don't know what's happened with other children.
Have you talked with people about the cluster bombs? We're hearing that there are unexploded cluster bombs that are just all over the place. One of our reporters told us a couple of months ago that he met with a family who had a cluster bomb sitting in the middle of their living room. What kind of stories have you come across?
Well, I actually came across one yesterday on the road between Fallujah and Hilla, and our car had to veer to avoid it. So they're definitely out there. I do know from what I read before I came over here that there's a large increase in the number of amputations of children's feet and hands because kids are kicking or picking up these cluster bombs. There's been an increase in genital injuries because kids will kick the cluster bombs and the bombs explode up. It's just the toll that those are taking here on the children of Iraq is unconscionable.
Hmm. Can you tell us about the current humanitarian situation there, Kelly?
Well, there is some food being given out. People did have food rations from before the war. Those are now kind of nearing their end. I have to say that really water is a major concern that people have, that they don't have running water, and they can't get drinking water, they can't take showers, they can't wash dishes. I mean, they can't do any of the normal things that people want to do to get their lives back together. And so I think the water is the major issue right now.
Kelly Hayes Raitt, we thank you very much for your time and your perspective. Any final thoughts on your part?
I have been very moved by how warmly people have welcomed me back, given the state of what's happened to them. That stranger that I met this morning who described his home being shelled handed me a painting that I had admired in his home before I left, and he said to me, "I would like to show the dignity and hospitality and honesty of the Iraqi people to you and give you this painting so that you will remember us." Here's a man whose home my government bombed almost, or shot at, and he was giving me a painting to remember him by. And that really is indicative of how the Iraqi people are.
Kelly Hayes Raitt is a board member of the Washington-based Education for Peace in Iraq Center. We reached her on the rooftop of her hotel in central Baghdad.
There's a natural mystic blowing through the air. If you listen carefully now, you will hear. This could be the first trumpet.
Bob Marley, Natural Mystic. Residents of a Baghdad suburb said they saw a U.S. soldier shot in the head early today as he browsed in a video store, according to the Associated Press. Reuters News is reporting that the U.S. military is holding six Iraqis for questioning in the disappearance of two U.S. soldiers missing from their post 45 miles south of Baghdad. Even their Humvee has disappeared. A military spokesman said a U.S. soldier was killed yesterday in an ambush near the city of Najaf. ABC News reports that yesterday, two soldiers and one Iraqi driver were killed in separate attacks on U.S. military targets. While the Bush administration has characterized these attacks as random acts of supporters of Saddam Hussein, the Arab television station Al Jazeera recently aired statements that indicate two unknown groups are urging assaults on U.S.-led forces in Iraq. One group, calling itself the Mujahideen of the Victorious Sect, claimed responsibility for recent attacks and promised more. The other, the Popular Resistance for the Liberation of Iraq, called on intellectuals, explosive experts, and others to, quote, take revenge against America. Discontent among Iraqi citizens is growing, according to a report by CNN. Veteran news correspondent Lamise Andoni monitors the media of the Middle East and has relatives living in Iraq with whom she is in constant contact. Andoni spoke with Peace Watch earlier this week about the surge of refugees leaving Iraq for Jordan.
I'm in constant contact with people who are coming and going from Iraq, Iraqis as well as journalists as well, especially Iraqis who were in Jordan during the war and went back and then came back to Jordan. And many Iraqis did not go back. They just, like the man of the family, would go back to see if he to assess the situation. And from what we are noticing here and observing in Jordan, is that people who thought that they could finally return to Iraq decided not to return to Iraq. And there are more people leaving.
And why are they leaving after thinking that they would perhaps return to Iraq?
Because they thought that there would be some of them, after the war, they went back to see if they could settle again, and they thought that the situation would be better. But they're leaving because they don't see any prospect for security and the economy, especially for the middle class, to get better. I mean, you either have to be a war profiteer, or I mean, a real big businessman, or if you're very poor, you can't leave. And what we are also noticing is that people who had asked for immigration before the war to Europe and Canada and New Zealand and other countries have not stopped their applications or have not changed their minds. The only people who really want back to stay are people who feel they have political future, like political leaders, and many people who are from the political parties, either the ones, I mean, not necessarily supported by the U.S., and they are the ones who are trying to do something. But average people who thought that things would be better are very worried about their safety, and they don't know what will happen, other that in the South, they're worried about some of them were very right-wing in the religious groups take over. I'm sure you've heard about incidents mm-hmm. where people were killed, or some Christian owners of alcohol shops where doors selling liquor were killed. So it's a total chaos, and they don't like the way the U.S. and the British are treating them. And the saying in Baghdad is, In the day, Baghdad streets are for the American troops, at night for the looters and the criminals.
Now, this trend towards people leaving Baghdad and Iraq, this sort of exodus, how would you characterize that? Are those just a few people that have, you know, decided to opt out, or is this something that is surprising to you? How many people are we talking about making this exodus?
I'm not sure, but I attended just recently, last week, a big conference on refugees. And the thing is that the UNHCR, which is the UN organization in charge of the Commission on Refugees, is under pressure by the donor countries to repatriate the Iraqi refugees. But the UNHCR itself doesn't think that people are safe to go back, or there are the conditions conducive and people are reluctant. They want to go back, but to go back permanently, it's not very encouraging. And I don't have numbers, but what we are seeing that people who had, there were around 300,000 Iraqis in Jordan, and in many of them had applied for immigration. And we hear every week of Iraqis immigrating or telling us that they're still waiting to immigrate. And or people who settled in Jordan, they went back to see how the situation is, and then they came back here. With some exceptions, but it's not like if you go to the borders, you see an exodus. It's people who already been refugees, many of them a big majority of them are not going back or sending a relative to see if things are going back. Mm. And people from the middle class feel that they should just go, especially those who have relatives in the West or in any in Arab countries, are now exploring ways to take all of the family out of Iraq.
Mm.
So it doesn't sound good at all. I mean, and Jordan is very worried about Iraq. Everybody is worried about Iraq, and it's obvious that the U.S. is in charge, not the Iraqis. Bremer was speaking at the World Economic Forum and leading an Iraqi delegation, and he was even telling people what kind of changes they'll make in the Constitution. I mean, it was bizarre.
Paul Bremer, the U.S.-installed authority in Iraq, was at the World Economic Forum telling people what changes were going to be made in the Iraqi Constitution?
Exactly. He even gave a list of the changes that will be made in the economy and the Constitution. They want to change the Constitution. To the main thing for the American administrator and the administration in Iraq is how to make it better for foreign investment because of the oil. And all of the changes he's talking about is about how to get foreigners to buy property in Iraq, to invest in Iraq, that's all. And he was telling us, and the Iraqi delegation was sitting with him, saying that we are technocrats, we're not politicians. And one Iraqi intellectual who was taking part in the conference, he stood up and said, "You don't represent Iraq. Why are you talking like that?" It was very embarrassing. And none of the Arab leaders meeting there responded to him. But at the same time, they didn't like it. Everybody was talking about a free, sovereign Iraq, free of occupation.
Bremer also spoke of over 100 newspapers having sprung up since the fall of Saddam Hussein, and he issued a proclamation recently that made it illegal for the press to oppose the U.S. occupation of Iraq. Now, you're a journalist, Lamise, and you monitor the media in the Middle East. What are your observations about this new media in Iraq?
Well, at the beginning, Iraqi parties, you know, in the 70s, there were many Iraqi parties who had newspapers before the crackdown in 79. So they, as soon as they came went back, some of them with very limited means started newspapers. And there are some with the support of the U.S. In fact, there are some newspapers, again, a very awkward situation. There are some newspapers that are distributed by the American army. It's very funny. And at the beginning, they were publishing freely. Then, because just like in the heat of the moment, but then Bremer has issued different decrees, not only about newspapers, about what they can say and can't say at the mosques and other public forums. I mean, because at the mosques they were preaching against occupation. And he said that he issued a decree saying that this is incitement against occupation, as well as the newspapers. So. And they've arrested many people. They've arrested even people who used to work with them.
Lamise Andoni, veteran news correspondent, speaking with us from Amman, Jordan. The U.S. House of Representatives yesterday rejected two attempts by Democratic lawmakers for additional inquiries into the handling of intelligence on Iraq's weapons programs. Democrats sought to include the inquiries in a bill authorizing 2004 intelligence activities. Meanwhile, West Virginia Congressman Robert Byrd delivered a scorching speech on the floor of the Senate earlier this week where he blasted the administration for saying that intelligence was not there to support the president's assertion that Iraq posed an imminent threat to the U.S.
The White House released a national security strategy that called for an end to the doctrines of deterrence and containment that have been a hallmark of American foreign policy for more than half a century. This new national security strategy is based upon preemptive war, something unheard of in the past experiences, practices, and policies of our nation. Such a strategy of striking first against possible dangers is heavily reliant upon interpretation of accurate and timely intelligence. If we are going to hit first based on perceived dangers. The perceptions had better be accurate. If our intelligence is faulty, we may launch preemptive wars against countries that do not pose a real threat against us. We had better be certain that we can discern the imminent threats from the false alarms. Just 96 days ago, President Bush announced that he had initiated a war to, quote, disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. The president told the world, our nation enters this conflict reluctantly, yet our purpose is sure. The people of the United States and our friends and allies will not live at the mercy of an outlaw regime that threatens the peace with weapons of mass destruction. The president has since announced that major combat operations concluded on May 1. Since then, Mr. President, the United States has been recognized by the international community as the occupying power in Iraq. And yet, Mr. President, we have not found any evidence that would confirm the officially stated reasons that our country was sent to war. We have heard a lot about revisionist history from the White House of late in answer to those who question whether there was ever a real threat from Iraq. But it is the president who appears to me to be intent on revising history. There is an abundance of clear and unmistakable evidence that the administration sought to portray Iraq as a direct and deadly and imminent threat to the American people. But there is a great difference between the hand-picked intelligence that was presented by the administration to Congress and the American people when compared against what we have actually discovered in Iraq. Whether or not intelligence reports were bent, stretched, or massaged to make Iraq look like an imminent threat to the United States, it is clear that the administration's rhetoric played upon the well-founded fears of the American public about future acts of terrorism. Many of these statements have nothing to do with intelligence, because they are at root just sound bites based on conjecture. They are designed to prey upon public fear. Just days before a vote on a resolution that handed the president unprecedented war powers, President Bush stepped up the scare tactics on October 7, just 4 days before the October vote in the Senate on the war resolution. The president had this to say. We know that Iraq and the Al-Qaeda terrorist network share a common enemy, the United States of America. We know that Iraq and Al-Qaeda have had high-level contacts that go back a decade. President Bush continued, we've learned that Iraq has trained Al-Qaeda members in bomb-making and poisons and deadly gases. Alliance with terrorists could allow the Iraqi regime to attack America without leaving any fingerprints. This is the kind of pumped-up intelligence and outrageous rhetoric that were given to the American people to justify war with Iraq. We hear some voices say, well, why should we care? After all, the United States won the war, didn't it? Saddam Hussein is no more. Iraq is no longer a threat. He is either dead or on the run, so what does it matter if reality does not reveal the same grim picture that was so carefully painted before the war? So what if the menacing characterizations that conjured up visions of mushroom clouds and American cities threatened with deadly germs and chemicals were overdone? So what? Well, Mr. President, our sons and daughters who serve in uniform answered a call to duty. They were sent to the hot sands of the Middle East to fight in a war that has already cost the lives of 194 Americans to this moment. Thousands of innocent civilians and unknown numbers of Iraqi soldiers. Our troops are still at risk. Hardly a day goes by that there is not another attack on the troops who are trying to restore order to a country teetering on the brink of anarchy. The president told the American people that we were compelled to go to war to secure our country from a grave threat. Are we any safer today than we were on March 18, 2003? It is in the compelling national interest, Mr. President, to examine what we were told about the threat from Iraq. This is not revisionist history. These words are plain English words. Mr. President, Congress must face this issue squarely. Congress should begin immediately an investigation into the intelligence that was presented to the American people about the pre-war estimates of Saddam's weapons of mass destruction and the way in which that intelligence might have been misused. I must watch my words carefully, for I may be tempted to use the words investigation or inquiry to describe this review. And those are terms which I am told are not supposed to be used. The proposed measures appear to fall short of what the situation requires. We're already shading our terms about how to describe the proposed review of intelligence. This is the same problem that got us into this controversy about slanted intelligence reports, word games. Well, Mr. President, this is no game. For the first time in our history, the United States has gone to war because of intelligence reports claiming that a country posed a threat to our nation. Congress should not be content to use standard operating procedures to look into this extraordinary matter. We should accept no substitute for a full bipartisan investigation by Congress into the issue of our pre-war intelligence on the threat from Iraq and the use of that intelligence. The longer questions are allowed to fester about what our intelligence knew about Iraq and when our intelligence knew it, the greater the risk that the American people whom we are elected to serve will lose confidence in their government. Many members of this body trusted so much that they gave the president sweeping authority to commence war. As President Reagan famously said, trust but verify. While the Reconstruction answers, so do the questions. And it is time to verify. For over half a century, I have witnessed deceit and scandal, cover-up and aftermath. I have seen presidents of both parties, who once enjoyed great popularity among the people, leave office in disgrace because they misled the American people. The business of intelligence is secretive by necessity, but our government is open by design. We must not go down the road of cover-up. That is the road to ruin.
Senior Democratic lawmaker Robert Byrd of West Virginia speaking on the floor of the Senate in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Vern Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.